Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we celebrate the release of David Fincher's latest masterpiece, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, with two phenomenal talents. First up, he's the visionary cinematographer whose breathtaking work enriches every moment of this magical film, Mr. Claudio Miranda. Then, his indelible themes are beautiful, delicate, and haunting in film after film, and this latest work is certainly no exception. Composer extraordinaire Alexandre Desplat. Prepare for Movie Geek Heaven, everyone. Movie Geeks United is coming up next.
My name is Benjamin. Benjamin Button. And I was born under unusual circumstances. The First World War had ended. And I've been told it was an especially good night to be born.
Welcome to the big show tonight, everybody. Good to have everyone here with us. This is Movie Geeks United, and I am one of your co-hosts. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. Welcome to what we have is a very big show for you tonight.
Yeah, this is going to be a great show. And I just want to say at the top here, we do have a chat room for all of you live listeners out there. If you click the chat available icon on your homepage, it'll take you right to it, and you'll be able to talk all things Benjamin Button. You can submit questions for our first guest tonight. It's a great tool there, especially for movie geeks like us. And why else would you be listening unless you're a movie geek like us?
That's right.
It's a family of geeks, you know.
It is a family
here.
Family of geeks, a very happy family, a very large family spread out throughout the world.
That's right, and we're very thankful for everyone out there.
Yes, we are.
This is going to be a great show, so let's get right started because we have a packed show this hour here, so let's get the ball rolling on this. Tonight we celebrate The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which opens nationwide Christmas Day. This magical and poetic film is based upon a short story by F. Scott Fitzgerald, and it's about a man who was born in his 80s and ages backward, observing the full course of an exceptionally colorful life along the way. This was a story so enigmatic and yet filled with such possibilities that it took many decades to craft just the right adaptation. And now, thanks to an amazing roster of talents, including screenwriter Eric Roth, director David Fincher, stars Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett, and the wonderful talents on our show tonight, they have done it. We begin tonight with a cinematographer of the film, Mr. Claudio Miranda, an artist who has quite a history with director David Fincher, having collaborated with him on the film Seven, Fight Club, The Game, and Zodiac prior to Benjamin Button. This extraordinary talent expresses Benjamin's epic journey with profound, detailed, and deeply moving imagery that will live in the hearts and minds of moviegoers for many, many years to come. And it is a great pleasure to welcome Claudio Miranda to Movie Geeks United. Mr. Miranda, hello.
Hey.
It's very
quite,
nice
that's
to...
Quite, that's quite an intro. I haven't had an intro quite like that. So.
Well, we appreciate you coming on very much. We're very thrilled to have you here. Let me start off by getting a sense from you of what first drew you to cinema and being a cinematographer in particular. When did that occur?
Well, you know, it's kind of strange. I think I'm unlike a lot of people where, you know, this kind of just kind of opened up its doors for me. You know, I gaffed some movies for Fincher, you know, and mm-hmm. Fight Club and those movies. And I kind of wanted to go off and do my own kind of shooting. And I turned down, gaffing a Panic Room. Because I said, oh, David, I just want to shoot a little bit. And he says, well, hey, you know, I got this Nike spot. You want to shoot that? And I go, cool, you know. So, you know, but it wasn't after, like, you know, truly seeking it, and, you know, and that it just sort of fell. But, you know, just, you know, I just do my homework and just, you know, look at references, and, you know, David and I have kind of a pretty common, you know, eye about things. You know,
right.
We kind of want the, you know, the simplest, and, you know, Benjamin Button's very, you know, naturalistic, you know, and we looked at some, you know, there was a lot of Andrew Wyeth kind of references, but not really as far as like tone, and but it was more like for like the sparseness, you know, I guess
right.
What was kind of represented, and you know, and Buttons, you'll see, you won't see a bunch of, you know, little knick-knack kind of things and cliche kind of items, and you know.
Mm.
No baguettes running down the street, you know, and the, you know, that kind of thing.
Right, right. And I definitely want to speak to you about Benjamin Button, but what does cinematography do for you? How does it fulfill you creatively? What about it are you passionate about, and how does it challenge you?
You know, I just kind of like how wacky you kind of get with it, and people to let you kind of go. I just think that's kind of, you know, I mean, I think when you try to be kind of, you know, conform to kind of a straight kind of, you know, I think when you're feeling safe and average, I think you're not doing anything special. You know, I don't
right.
know. I mean, there's a couple scenes that, you know, I just love, you know, I mean, I have to kind of talk about some of them, but, you know, there's like one scene we lit with a bulb in the room and almost that's
wow.
it, you know what I mean? And just, I mean, and not faking like a source for somewhere else. And then kind of going like, is this cool? Or is this just, you know, normally we don't do this. You know, I think, you know, I mean, those kind of make you kind of just feel like, wow, that's cool. That looks great. You know, I mean, you know, it's a little bit of a, I don't know, I think bravery pill kind of thing to do. But I just, you know, when
yeah.
you do that and it turns out great, you just kind of go like, and then you just have these little rewards to go like, that's cool, you know.
Well, that kind of takes me in two directions here, what you just said. And to tackle the first, I would think that kind of risk-taking would come with the territory when it comes to working with Mr. Fincher, because he, I find, and many people do, that he's one of the most daring filmmakers we have,
mm-hmm.
Obviously. Tell me about that relationship, particularly on this project. What is the dialogue that exists between the two of you?
You know, it's actually not that much dialogue. We just kind of get it, you know what I mean? It's, you know, we just, I spent, you know, David, you know, we talked about, you know, what the look of the room should look like. You know, we do a lot of location scout photos, and we go like, you know, wow, this just looks great like it is, you know? I mean, you know, my little bit of, you know, comment is that, you know, we have to make that look the same for, you know, 4 to 6 hours, you know what I mean? So, unfortunately, the sun, you know, it moves, you know, so things don't stay the same, and, you know, so then here comes lighting and, you know, and all that kind of stuff, you know, and, but I try to still emulate, you know, that single photograph I took, you know, and try
mm-hmm.
to make the room feel like it's not, you know, not sourced or anything by anything totally artificial, you know, and
right.
and let actors roam around the space and don't go like, you know, their actor, hit actor with light, you know, kind of approach the lighting, you know, which I think is
mm.
a big mistake, you know.
Well, all of his movies are just so breathtakingly photographed. I mean, I think that Seven is one of the all-time great-looking movies. So when you sat down with the script, what was the visual tone? Because it takes place over the course of many decades. So were there different kind of palettes and different tones that you guys were adapting for each of those?
Well, we wanted to kind of, you know, I did some research of when, you know, fluorescence took over, you know, when they started, you know, and New Orleans was like one of the first cities to have, like, believe it or not, like, you know, a common electrical system.
Oh.
And so we just looked at, you know, gas lamps to, you know, when it, you know, New Orleans stopped with gas lamps and started with electrical lamps and you know, and fluorescence came across pretty early. I forgot what the year is, but I think I used them. You know, like in the, I always think fluorescents are kind of like a 60s thing, but actually they started, you know, I mean, like, I think they were kind of invented around the 20s or 30s or something like that. And,
mm.
You know, I have them in the period around the 40s. And, you know, so I kind of, you know, I did kind of play a little bit true to form on some of those things, you know, and as far as the eras of, you know, when lighting kind of came around and, You know, we used some vintage bulbs that were kind of mock-ups of 1914. It was like a tent sequence, which we used all these kind of, and they're really kind of these warm, golden, you know, completely not efficient, you know, bulbs at all. You know, it was amazingly how dark 60 watts was back in the, you know, the 20s, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, we just look at it as from really being natural. I mean, there's a lot of, like, bulbs that actually are really doing a lot of the, you know, the horsepower in lighting, you know. So our approach
right.
was being as natural as possible, and I really tried to go, like, you know, God, you know, there's, you see, you know, a scene where, I think it's maybe in one of the pictures, where it's, you know, Benjamin Button. Did you see the movie?
I haven't seen the movie either.
There's been, like, so many, like, screenings and things like that. But it's like... but anyway, there's like this one bulb.
I live in the middle of nowhere. So.
Oh, okay. Well, that might be. Well, anyway, there's like this one bulb right next to his bed, and he's saying goodbye to you know, Mr. Odie, and it's like there's a bulb in the room, and
uh-huh.
you know, beyond maybe a slight little, you know, soul card, you know, that's it. You know, I mean, and it's just, I don't know, it just feels cool. You know, I don't know. You look at it, and I go like, man, that's.
Yeah, but there's also something. You talk about using minimal lighting. Is that something that the new technology allows you to do more so than the traditional film?
I think that's a misconception, you know. I think a misconception is that, you know, HD, you have to, you know, all of a sudden not light and not think and, you know, just kind of like, hey, you know, I can get a bulb and I can shoot. You know, you can make those choices, you know, with film as well. I just think that you could see the result much quicker. You know what I mean? So you could say like, oh, well, you know, I'm looking at the screen. All I need is a couple lights. You know, I don't need this, you know, this whole thing. But you still like, I mean, you know, we, you know, I had, you know, the top of the Button house, you know, and we still had, you know, a bunch of, you know, 1420Ks on top of it. I mean, so
right.
So I mean, you know, and I was still wide open on the thing. So it's not like you need less light. You know, I think in fact maybe you might need actually more. You know, in some sense. You know.
Well, what is the advantage of the digital technology? Is it
well for David? It's just, you know, it's for actors and slating and reloads. He just likes
right.
to kind of be able to kind of when we roll set. There's no slate that's being clapped in front of the lens. It's mm-hmm. basically a, you know, we just it's just go, you know,
well,
and keep on going. Oh, that's a nice thought you have. Keep on going. You know, well let's
yeah.
keep on going with this theme and then you know just. You know, without having to kind of go like, oh, well reload, you know, so we just, so that's a little bit of part of it. And he likes kind of like watching playback instantly, watching, you know, making sure that, you know, you're not watching an NTSC signal video tap. You're watching the full, you're watching your kind of, your kind of, I guess your
yeah.
release print, you know, in a way, you know,
right.
you're looking kind of
right.
a version of the print. You're watching your negative actually run around, you know, and it's,
yeah.
you know, so in a way
it's
that kind of attracts David, you know.
It's really transformed how movies are made. It's just beginning. I mean, have we just scratched the surface of what this technology is capable of, do you think?
God, we pushed it pretty far. You know, we pushed it to the brink, the brink of the poor little camera could do. You know, but you know, I mean, yeah, we did push it. I mean, it couldn't do everything. There is film on buttons. You know, I mean, there's.
Okay.
And others like slow motion and stuff that we didn't feel like was ready for you know, film doesn't do it really well. I mean, digital doesn't do it very well. Film does it pretty beautifully. So there's slow motion scenes and there's scenes where we're kind of in the Caribbean, you know, and underwater, of course, you know, that's on film, you know.
Yeah.
And,
you talked about the convenience for the actors, and that's part of what attracts Fincher to this technology. How much communication, I've always wondered this, how much communication does a DP have with the actors?
You just want to help them a little bit, you know? I mean, I didn't have that much with, I mean, I just feel like, you know, Kate and Brad were so pretty amazing. I didn't really have that much of a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, we just, it wasn't about, like, trying to make them beautiful, you know, or anything like that. So I didn't have to, like, you know, hit your light. I mean, there was kind of nothing of that, you know what I mean? They just needed to move in their space to act. So, In blocking, we just kind of figured it just kind of just self worked itself out. I don't know, it didn't seem like there was that much of a conversation, you know.
Well, with blocking and camera movement and that sort of thing, obviously directors and cinematographers have varying styles. In your mind, what do you like the camera to do? What is its place? Is it to observe, to be an active participant? What are your thoughts on
that? I like when it's more observational. I hate when it's too much of a participant. I think it draws the audience away from the camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like when it's sort of there to kind of like, here's the thing happening in this room. David, you know, is amazing. You know, we shot in that little, there's a little hospital scene where the story's kind of told from. And it's amazing. You could be in one room and the whole, you know, we were there for 2 weeks and, you know, we hardly hit the same place twice. If you can imagine shooting 2 weeks in a room. It's just like, you know, this,
wow.
It's blocking. I don't like that. You know, I'm not a big, huge fan of wiggly cam, you know, wobbly cam.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I just think it pulls it away too much, you know, from, you know, I'm just not into that. I mean, maybe there's a place or something like that, but and I think it can be subtle, but I just think all of a sudden the camera has a personality, you know, at this
mm-hmm.
point, you know, and this story doesn't need that, you know.
It could take you out of the movie if the camera itself became another kind of active character in it,
mm-hmm.
is what you're
I
saying?
Think so, yeah, I think so. And I've done it, handheld and, you know, run around. And sometimes when you're looking through the eyepiece, you don't think it's that bad. But when you watch it, like, you know, 30 by, you know, 50 or whatever it is, you know, you go like, wow, that's nauseating, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Right.
I'm wondering what the most challenging part of this project was for you.
Well, we dealt a lot with, you know, blue screens and, like this, the boat itself, the main, you know, the tugboat that's in the movie.
Right.
You know, that's in blue screen, so it's completely artificial lighting. You know, so we had, you know, and it has many looks to that boat. There's moonlight, there's sunlight, there's, and, you know, because you're in a boat, it's not always, it's sun up from the port, aft, rear, you know, front, it's overcast. It's slightly overcast. And we just used different types of lamps for different kind of feelings and moonlight, no moonlight, just strip black, just practicals only on the boat at night and snow. I mean, you know, snow at night, snow at day. I mean, there's fog. I mean, just a...
Wow. All the elements.
All the elements. You know, this boat went through everything. And I think if you look at it, it's pretty, you know, impressive all the different places this little boat, you know, was, you know, even though it was just on, you know, the Sony stage.
Right. When you, obviously you've worked so hard at crafting these images and this film, and when you're able to sit back and watch it with an audience, as I'm sure you have in these screenings, what's the most satisfying part for you of that experience?
It's been received really positively. Everyone seems to have good things to say about the movie, you know, and I kind of, I watch this movie and it's kind of David's first, you know, touching movie, you know,
mm-hmm.
and,
right.
And, you know, I get kind of, you know, I'm not the most weepy person in the world, but, it can make you a little weepy, you know.
The trailer makes me weepy, I won't lie to you.
You know, I mean, you know, David's not known for the, you know, the big weepy factor.
That's true.
So.
Yeah, I am the most weepy person in the world. So I know
weepy,
for a fact.
Definitely weepy. You know, my girlfriend read the original script, and it should be kind of before I did, and all I hear is just bawling tears. You know.
Well, can you tell me who in your line of work who inspires you?
I guessed for Harris Savinas, you know, on The Game.
Right, okay.
And I, I worked with, you know, Derek Wolski, you know, on some early movies, you know. I did, Crimson Tide and The Crow and all those kind of things. And, you know, I've learned from both those people, and those are kind of the people that I kind of look after, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
There's Conrad Hall, you know, there's Conrad and... You know, I learned a lot from, you know, Harris of just how to kind of make things kind of not perfect. Don't always, like, you know, kind of, you know, he kind of messes things up, and it kind of just
right.
needs to help, you know, and, you know, and you know, from Derek Wolski, I've learned, like, you know, just, you know, watch the set. You know, guys are, like, panning a lamp in, and all of a sudden, you know, it's not panned through the frame or it's just panned off and something's kind of beautiful happening. And you go, like, wow, just, you know, you just watch for those little things that are, like, yeah, the light's not aiming at him, but it, and it's kind of off the frame and spilling and doing something kind of weird. But isn't that cool? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like those little surprises, and just keep your eyes open for them, you know. And that's kind of what the people that I've worked for kind of taught me, you know, just to watch that.
Well, when you're kind of creating the look you want for this film, drafting it out, do you look to other movies for inspiration, or is that you don't want to copy, obviously? But
it didn't. I mean, sometimes I go, you know, like, some movies don't pay attention to continuity of lighting sometimes, and sometimes that works or not, or you kind of know when to bend it, and I've learned kind of when it's important, you know, those kind of lighting continuity issues, you know, like, but, you know, I took, you know, since we were shooting on digital, I took all the, at the end of the day, I was given a little thumb drive of all the digital stills, you know, that you know, the Viper took, you know, and I took it to home. And I just kind of did my own color grading, you know, and I posted on a site for David and I to look. And
right.
I just found that as I was kind of looking at it, it just sort of became its own thing, you know. And, you know, I printed a book up, and, you know, David and I were looking, and we just looked at this thing and go, like, you know, this feels right for this. And, you know, and I knew that it possibly could change in DI when you have, you know, the whole thing assembled. And things did change in DI. Things, you know, had... There's a whole, like, I forget what the sequence is called, but it's a series of chain of events scene where
right.
it's just, you know, like, if this didn't happen, this didn't happen, you know, this set of circumstances would not have happened, and that had kind of a different color, color hue to it. It was more kind of desat blue kind of feel, and that was a little
right.
bit, and I was kind of initially kind of going with something else. And but we want to kind of feel like this is kind of like a side story. So a lot of the little side stories in Benjamin Button have a little bit of a different look to them. You know, some of the little lightning scene where this guy gets, you know, hit by lightning, and that's definitely like this old vintage film look, you know.
Right. Fincher is pretty meticulous, isn't he, as a director?
Oh, yeah. No, very meticulous. I mean, he's... The DI has been, you know, the digital line where we time the movie has been, you know, for long. I mean, David's been working on this movie forever, you know. I mean, just when I thought it was like 4 years, I realized he was putting, you know, he was working on this movie before Zodiac, you know.
Wow.
And I got
Zodiac.
Hired on kind of last, you know, sort of last minute, you know, a little bit, you know. But.
Zodiac, you mentioned that, another just masterpiece of
dynamo
a movie.
Of a film.
Wow.
And I just did the, you know, Harris was the cinematographer on that one. I just did the, you know, just the, you know, I just did some reshoots of it for
right.
like 3 weeks of that. But, you know, Harris was the, you know, and for me, you know, my goal was to, you know, keep what Harris was doing and keep it going for the movie, you know. The interesting thing, you know, Button was more, you know, it's kind of a little bit more, you know, I, you know, it's just more me. And I had more, you know, choices to make
right.
my own. And
this is a... I'm not wanting to jinx anything, and I'm sure I'm not, because this is exceptional work that you've done. But obviously, it's award season, and I'm wondering what does that do to you? Do you try to just leave it out of your mind, or does it fill you with some sense of adrenaline at all? Or
I don't know. I don't know how to kind of like think about that. You know, because I just kind of go like. If I think about it, will it happen? If I don't think about it, I feel like I had, like, something, I don't know. I mean, you know, I kind of been watching, like, in movies that I think are kind of going to be close, and, you know. Like.
right.
And then kind of like, you know, maybe, I don't know. Oh, God, that's pretty good, you know.
Well, when you just tell me that you'll call into our show when you're on the red carpet.
Yeah, exactly
on the red carpet.
So what's next for you? What's coming up?
Interesting enough, I'm prepping Tron.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. That was just announced as it's going to be shot entirely in 3D. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I just came from test today on that. You know.
Wow. Yeah. How is the 3D working? I remember when it came out in the.
It's much better than when I was a kid watching, like, you know, Metal Storm or whatever that was.
Right.
I would hope so.
When I was like, you know, whatever, 7.
Yeah, I remember going to the store and getting the 3D glasses and watching Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Oh,
on
yeah, and
television.
It never worked. It didn't look horrible.
No,
my friend's sister cried. It didn't work. I mean,
no,
yeah.
it's gone. You know, it's gotten so much better than it was. You know, back then. But
obviously, yeah.
It's a different kind of movie. I mean, you know, it's.
Well, you're that's going to be quite a job right there.
Yeah.
Well, it's not. They're actually building a lot of these sets, which it's kind of reason why I kind of took it. You know, they weren't doing I was just worried to be surrounded by blue screen and people just not touching anything real.
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing is about it, there's a real reality to this what they want to do and build a lot of these sets, and I just think that's a great thing. So.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well. We wish you the best of luck with Tron, and we certainly wish you the best of luck with Benjamin Button. And, I mean, great work, my friend. And you're welcome back here on the show anytime you'd like.
Anytime.
Oh, great.
See, that was painless, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know,
did fine. You did excellent.
All right. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. That is cinematographer Claudio Miranda, a great talent.
We just got a major scoop. We got a major scoop. That's a big deal.
We got a scoop in the second half about the new Terrence Malick movie as well.
Yeah, so, I mean,
oh,
it's just scoop.
Yeah, you don't know that yet.
I don't know that, but I would imagine our good friend Aaron got some stuff out of him.
Some scoopty scoops, yeah. This is a show of scoops. If you're a movie fan, I mean, where else do you want to be?
I want to be here. I always like when you send the bulletins out on Facebook. I'm like, hey, wait a minute, I'm on there. I don't need to worry about being invited. I'm on there.
That's right. But you agree to show up anyway. That's always very nice of you.
Well, where else would I be?
Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. We're about to enter the second half of our celebration of the release of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, the latest masterpiece from David Fincher, and we got an exciting interview coming up. This was a tough one to schedule because this gentleman is very busy, and he's currently in London, and he called from he was working in the Abbey Road studio.
Wow.
Yeah, so we want to thank, obviously, Mr. Desplat and his publicity team. And actually, we could only schedule the interview for a time when I was not available earlier today, so we had our very own home entertainment correspondent, Aaron Diaz, fill in, and he did a great job with the interview, so we want to thank him, too.
Yes.
I just want to read a couple of these credits for this man. Girl with the Pearl Earring.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful soundtrack. I love that one, too.
Syriana, The Painted Veil, The Queen, and the one that we're very much crazy about, which is Birth.
Beautiful. I mean, but I forgot The Girl with the Pearl Earring. I thought the soundtrack of that was just magnificent.
Yeah.
But Birth is exceptional.
And you and I have the same reaction when we saw Birth and it started. And he actually speaks to this in this interview. Just incredibly captivating from the beginning. And you actually, for the first time, you kind of perked up and thought, man, what music.
Oh, it was mind-blowing.
Yeah. Music is just so, it's a little bland in service of the movie, and it's you can anticipate it and expect what it'll sound like. His scores are very captivating and original.
They are. They really are.
We're talking, of course, about Alexandre Desplat, and he's one of the few composers whose musical expressions can take a film beyond mere images on the screen and straight up into the heavens. He's been honored to with significant industry recognition, including a Golden Globe win for The Painted Veil and an Oscar nomination for The Queen, just nominated for a Golden Globe Award for his gorgeous score for Benjamin Button. Mr. Desplat calls us from London earlier today, where he's working at Abbey Road Studios, as I mentioned. And in this conversation, he discusses his collaboration with Fincher, the tone of the film's music, and his upcoming projects, which include Terrence Malick's upcoming film, Tree of Life.
Wow.
And the Meryl Streep, Julia Child's movie, Julie and Julia.
Julia, okay.
He worked on as well. And to close the show tonight after this interview, stick around because we're going to premiere a track from his score to Benjamin Button. So I'm sure everyone will look forward to that. So here it is, Alexandre Desplat.
What drew you first to music? I understand you started playing the piano as a child. What drew you to that?
Well, my parents were very fond of listening to a lot of different kind of music. And they just put the three children to the conservatory to learn how to play an instrument. And as my older sister did, when I was five, I went near piano and I started learning piano. But my sisters were playing piano, so I got a little bit upset of doing the same thing as the girls were doing. So I liked what my father was listening to, which was Louis Armstrong and Coleman Hawkins, and I thought maybe trumpet would be good. I started learning trumpet until I had kind of a clash with my teacher and didn't like the teacher very much and switched to flute.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I became a flutist. And one day I just went into composing.
Right. You've been composing for film for quite a long time. You know, American audiences, you know, they might just be, you know, seeing your name for the last 4 or 5 years. But you started composing in movies in the mid 80s project.
Well, I think my first short movie was in 82 or 3, and the first feature was in 85 or 86, yes.
Yeah.
Quite a long time ago already. I feel like an old man, especially with my broken voice from having a cold.
Okay.
I really sound like I'm 95, which I'm not.
Okay, you're still a relatively young man. How did you get into film composing?
It's a passion thing, you know. I was a cinephile and going to see movies all the time, and I started noticing the soundtracks, and started collecting movie soundtracks. And of course, the rare things were not the French things, because you could find the French things. The rare things were the American things,
mm-hmm.
like the soundtracks of Waxman and Korngold and North. And I started to, you know, to try and find in flea markets and shops these rare records, like Taras Bulba or the Vikings or
mm-hmm.
Picnic, these kind of soundtracks. And I just realized how much there was an opportunity of writing good music and associate it to the other passion I had, which was cinema. But it worked. You could really do something that would write something that would stand alone. I think that's what really brought me into movies, the passion of movies mixed with the passion of music.
Was it one score in a particular film, or is it one particular composer that you got hooked on that really got you really got into this?
I can remember many little streams that made a big river. For example, when I say many streams, little streams, I mean like listening to Bill Evans playing Spartacus Love theme by Alex North.
Mm-hmm.
You go, oh, I really have to get the score of that if I don't have this vinyl, the score of the complete score of Spartacus, and then you go and you see Star Wars and you think, wow, there's so much there that is near from my classical education. Stravinsky, Prokofiev, Ravel, Debussy, all put into one brain, which is John Williams' incredible talent and all these amazing melodies and so complex and but still fine orchestrations. And you see the Hitchcock movies and you go, wow, the music is so strong and so important. It makes 75% of the movie. And the same with Fellini and Rota. So it's really many, many little streams that fed my big river of love for movie soundtracks.
What do you think of when you hear something almost minimalist by John Williams, like Jaws or Michel Legrand for, Summer 42 or Love Story, where it's not, the big orchestral and it's very minimalist. What do you think when you hear that?
I love it. I love it too. On the many movies I've done in France and in England, many of them had no orchestra. There was a string quintet or a string quartet with a few players, or a jazz combo. I've been trained in doing these kind of scores, actually, these minimal scores. And yes, Incidental Tourist might be one of the best scores of John Williams, but there's not a huge, thing. A huge sound, but just an intimate sound. And of course, Summer of 42, which is jazzy, is fabulous. And one of my favorite scores by Bernard Herrmann is The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which is the more intimate score that he wrote, possibly. And Taxi Driver. So I'm rather keen when and happy when the score can drift and blend with different influences. The other one I could name is Ascenseur pour l'échafaud, music by Miles Davis for Louis Malle.
Right.
So there's many scores that I love and that really influence me in this also very intimate level of sound. And again, that's one of the first things I said when I came to America, that in France we don't use many orchestras in the scores. We don't want to have an orchestra intruding in a bedroom or in a cafe.
Well, I'm sure every composer has their own philosophy of what a score should do, whether it should accentuate or be counterpoint to a scene. What do you feel a score should do for a film?
I think it has to enhance the imagination, the hidden emotions. That's the way a score should work. Because what we see on screen, we don't care. We see it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to underline it. I guess that's more European sensitivity. That what you see, you don't have to repeat. And I think actually that's what David Fincher wanted me to do also.
Right.
Or Ang Lee or directors I've worked with, they want the score to have this quality of creating another dimension of imagination.
Well, and Fincher has said that he was a big fan of your great score for Birth, and I'm curious, how did he describe what he wanted musically for Benjamin Button? What was his dictate, if you will, if he had one?
Well, Birth, the dictate of the director of Birth, Jonathan Glazer, was, Alexandre, can you write a non-score? And I said, oh yeah, I'd love to. And that's what we tried really hard. A non-score being something that doesn't follow that does not repeat the action, but creates another dimension. And that's exactly what David wanted, that the music would create a world of emotion that we could share and have empathy with Benjamin Button, the character played by Brad Pitt, and never, ever underline or accentuate the love story, but just make it more moving or more desperate or more sorrowful. Again, create another, I can't say better than that, just create another dimension, another depth of field.
Would it seem that Fincher could, he is a big music guy, whether he's used, source music in his movies or with music videos and so forth. So it would seem that he really thinks in almost music terms. His movies have kind of, you could say, movements, if you will. And so I was wondering, was it an easy dialogue of between you and him on what he wanted for the film?
Very easy, because, as you say, he's trained, he's very experienced, and he's got a good taste, and he has, so when you play something that's not exactly right, he can very quickly analyze and understand why it's not in the right direction. They leave you freedom, but they expect you to surprise them and to reach a land that they've not explored, that they've not thought of, and that's what they want. They want you to be even more brave than they are. And that's, of course, it's a lot of pressure and a lot of anxiety and questioning, but it's the best way to stretch and find, again, to go to terra incognita.
I saw the film, and I was really struck when I was watching the movie that here was an epic. I mean, it's an epic film, and it spans decades. And yet the score, for a long time, is very delicate. Was that something Fincher said that needed it to be, or is that just the way when you saw the images, like, you know what, these images just need a little, you know, they need a light touch versus something, you know, big, if you will?
Well, it's all that together, yes, a light touch. Also, follow Benjamin Button,
mm-hmm.
which are his emotions. And he's a very laid-back character in the movie. He's not very active. You know, he's watching the world around him with a very kind perspective.
Mm-hmm.
He's very gentle and very... He's a man who likes to love the mankind. And the music couldn't be aggressive or arrogant. There's something that wouldn't match. So I think the music had to be... I thought the music had to be tender and very delicate. The other element is the sound of the movie, which is very full. Could it be because of the environment of music in New Orleans, but also because of the voiceovers
mm-hmm.
that are there most of the time? Could it be his voiceover or old Cate Blanchett's voiceover, which is narrating the movie?
Mm-hmm.
So you had to. I just say like a little, like a snake, you know. The movie had the music had to go very, very, very in very minimal little holes and blossom a little bit and then hide again. And it's like going in a mysterious forest.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go loud. You can't go loud. You have to go. You got to be very precise and delicate.
Is there one particular musical cue or sequence that you did where you're like, you know what, that's perfect of image and music coming together in the film, in Benjamin Button? Is there a sequence?
Well, it's hard for me to say that, because perfection is something that we will never reach.
Right.
I can think of moments that move me,
mm-hmm.
but it's the mix of everything, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the journey of the movie that makes at a twine point you're moved. I've seen actually people in the theater crying at moments that were not sad, but just because they had to release the emotion that had taken them for a few minutes on a previous scene.
Mm-hmm.
And on a funny scene, they would release the emotion and cry. It was very, very moving. I don't know. I like very much the opening, Mr. Gâteau, this Clocksmith character. I think there's something really magical there. And I like very much the love theme. I like when the two characters make love.
Mm-hmm.
When they meet, you know, when for the first time the two bodies get together.
Right.
And when they, many years later, they get together again. I like these two moments very much. I think that David made such a beautiful work there of
mm-hmm.
holding the emotion back to release it at the very, very moment where you can't hold your tears because it's so strong and so moving.
Right. Is there a difference of scoring in filming for European films versus American films?
I think things have changed a lot in the last 10 years, 15 years. I think film music is using new tools, not only the electronic, but I mean new tools that come from concert music. Could it be from the very contemporary composers, from Boulez to Stockhausen or John Cage, but also from the minimalists, Glass, Adams, Reich, and the way some composers in the 80s started to try different directions in films having not only a huge orchestra playing loud and following the action. If today we would write a Vertigo kind of score on a movie, it would be very weird. It would be rather inappropriate. So I think that's the difference between European scores and American scores have shrunk a lot in that mm-hmm. level. Now, in terms of budget, of course, American budgets are bigger, mm-hmm. and the tradition also mm-hmm. is more into having a larger sound of the
right.
score. But aside from that, I think the directors are more, of artists of my generation, between 35 and 45, they have this sensitivity, and this aesthetic, which is more about creating what I said before, another
mm-hmm.
world, and not just following the action. And that you can find directors like this in America, like Fincher, or in England, like Jonathan Glazer, or Peter Weber, or in France, like Jacques Audiard, who's the best French director. They share the same desire of a score that would
mm-hmm.
create another world.
You've gotten a lot of critical citations, and you did get nominated for The Queen, and you've been nominated, I believe, for Golden Globe for Benjamin Button. So what would a nomination mean, again, for Benjamin Button?
Well, you know, the Oscars is the top of the tops
mm-hmm.
of the actors, of all the technical, below-the-line people, and, all, of course, the best of the composers, the best of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So to be part of that bunch is a tremendous reward, to be honored by or heard as a musician by your peers
mm-hmm.
is a strong emotion, and also because the history of the Oscars shows the names of the composers that I have admired, from Maurice Jarre, Georges Delerue, Michel Legrand,
mm-hmm.
Francis Lay for the French, Gabriel Yared, of course, and
mm-hmm.
for the last years, and all the American composers, Herman, Williams, Goldsmith, Emma Bernstein.
Mm-hmm.
So to be suddenly part of that list is a dream, it's a child's dream. So it would be marvelous to be nominated again. I would be more than honored and happy. It's marvelous.
Well, and I want to ask you about two projects that are in the works, and I'm curious what the status of one of them. But I've talked to production designer Jack Fisk about the film, and I got to ask about Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life, and I'm wondering what those spotting sessions are like, because, you know, Malick is notorious for going through many edits of the film, be it longer or shorter, and really, you know, going back and forth. So have you started on that, or what's the status of that?
I can't really comment on that. The only thing I can't really comment on that. The only comment I can give is that Terrence Malick is not looking for a movie score.
Okay.
He's looking for music. And he's just seeking for the music that will fit, and that will give the rhythm and the emotion that he's seeking for.
Mm-hmm.
The rest is not important. Should it start here? Should it start there? I think that's the least of his issues, concerns. But that's all I can say so far.
Well, I look forward to that. And then the other film, which I assume because it's directed by Nora Ephron, it might be a real change of pace. But Julie and Julia, what how's that score? What's that score like working with Nora Ephron?
Well, Nora is a very precise writer.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, when the music comes to the picture, it's got to be very, very precise, as any comedy should be, because
mm-hmm.
the pace, as you know, is crucial. And the precision of every single entry of music is crucial. It brings me back to my European or French training, because
mm-hmm.
I've done a few comedies, of course, in France
mm-hmm.
and in England, where you learn to find the right balance between not being goofy and still being light. I think it's very difficult to write the score of a comedy, very, very difficult, because you always are on a thin thread that can easily put you down if you go too funny, it becomes very cheesy, and it
mm-hmm.
kills the movie. So, in terms of orchestration, the movie is set mostly in France in the 50s. So I've used my ability to mix jazz
mm-hmm.
guitar, and jazz piano, and accordion, and write waltzes for strings, and this kind of.
I would think that the film would be kind of exciting in that it would be the best of both worlds in that here's an American film, but it's a comedy, but then it's set in the 50s in France, and so you get to draw on that history, and you really get to it gives you an opportunity to kind of mix and match a lot of stuff that has influenced you up to this point.
Yeah, well, it was really a lot of fun to do, as you say, using all my tools, all my colors, because I've got many tools in my bag that I've tried through the years, and I've tried on this one to mix some of them and put them together in a new order, and I think Nora was really happy. I think it works really well, and the movie is really, really funny. Meryl Streep is fantastic, and Amy Adams is really sweet, and it's a great movie. It's a beautiful movie. It's moving. Funny enough, it's a moving movie, and very emotional, and still very, very funny, like Nora Ephron knows to do.
Well, I look forward to it. I got to ask real quick, just because I'm a major music fan and critic also, along with being a film critic,
mm-hmm.
and that you're... You said you were calling from Abbey Road Studios.
Yeah.
So what's it like being, I'm sure you've been to all kinds of studios and all over the world, but what's it like being in that studio with that history, the Abbey Road Studio? That's pretty amazing.
Well, Abbey Road Studios, when you look on the walls, you see pictures of all the great conductors, Carl Jung and Daniel Barenboim playing with Jacqueline Dupré and you know that John Williams is a ghost of in these walls, and a photo of Shirley Bassey
right.
in the 60s in her pink dress. it's a historical building. It's like going to a museum. You're in a kind of a temple here. So you try to learn a lot
mm-hmm.
and behave and be the best as you can, because these people are looking at you from every corner of the corridors.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Desplat, I want to thank you for taking the time out. I know you have a busy schedule. I think it's a great film, and it's a terrific score. I've listened to it a few times, and I'll be listening to it quite a bit. And good luck with it, and I can't wait for your next
thank
one,
you.
Be a Life in Julie and Julia. I think that'll be terrific. So thank you. And
thank you very much.
Back again. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Alexander Splatt.
That was a fantastic interview. That was just chock full of information. I liked how he would talk about mentioning the older scores, like from his childhood and his teen years.
Yeah.
And like
yeah.
a lot of stuff that I grew up, like the score for the Vikings and the stuff, the Alex North scores. I mean, just beautiful, beautiful scores.
You know, and I called Aaron as I was cutting this interview today. And I told him, he mentioned one of my favorite scores that nobody ever talks about, and that's The Accidental Tourist, John Williams.
Yeah, no, that's a good, that's right. I mean, it's a shame. I mean, I wish you could have spoken to him too, because I know I heard that. I was like, oh shit, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never hear that name, and that tells you just how geeky I am. That made me happy.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. No, it was a fantastic interview. Both interviews tonight
it really
was fantastic.
Yeah, couldn't ask for better. And the man himself is on the line, and I want to bring him on because he's seen it.
So
he's
yeah,
seen
bring
the
him
movie.
On.
Let's get a quick glimpse of what he thought of it. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, fellas?
Hey, excellent job, Aaron.
Thank you, and that's an excellent. It's not so much me. That's called an excellent job of editing.
No, it's you, buddy. So tell me, first of all, thank you so much, because I called Aaron like 45 minutes to an hour before I needed him to interview one of the great film composers, and he accommodated. He's so generous. But you saw the movie, as we mentioned, and you haven't talked to us about it yet. So tell us your thoughts on it. What impressed you about it?
I went to a early critic screening, and it was kind of wild that I got the invitation because and they played it at a theater because the mandate apparently from the studio is that they wanted to show it digitally, projected digitally. You know, that was like the mandate. So I was like, okay, so I'm down with that. So I went, and I'm definitely going to see it again Christmas Day, you know, or shortly after that. And it's an odd film, and the way I keep describing it in that it's an epic film that is as light as a feather. And that's a real contradiction, but that's also very F. Scott Fitzgerald. I'm an F. Scott Fitzgerald fan. I have not read everything F. Scott Fitzgerald has written, but the stuff I have read, you know, I'm a big fan. I think Great Gatsby is one of those perfectly written books, novels.
Yeah.
I have not read the short story that this is based on, and all my readings of it tell me that it's actually kind of a doodle by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Right.
It's not actually that good. And I can understand that. And I actually think that's kind of interesting. And I can understand that Fincher would be drawn to that and say, you know, this is not actually that good, but there is something here that I can.
There's a promise there. Yeah, there's a promise there. And like I said in the intro, it's got enormous possibilities. And I think because it kind of felt like an unfinished piece, in a way, that's why it took so long to develop. I mean, this goes back to Sherry Lansing, I think. She got a hold of it. Variation Spielberg at one time was going to direct it. It took a while.
A lot of reviews have come out, and a lot of people love it, and there's also a lot of critics who, you know, it's a real head-scratcher, and when I see it again, I will have fully formatted my view, and I can make a real lucid argument. I do think it's a great film. I think it's a marvelous film. I think it's a terrific film.
Okay.
And I sort of do understand critics who say that there's, you know, they dismiss it like, well, I don't get it. There's nothing. It's simple. It is a simple film. And it's to me, it's in its simplicity that it really, you know, it's not fussy, even for its length. It's 2.5 hour length. It's not a fussy epic. And there's a lot of comparisons. A lot of people have glibly compared it to, like, Forrest Gump. And
I was going to ask about that. Is that a valid comparison?
No, other than it goes from, this guy's life, and this guy has a kind of, you could say, an abnormality. You know,
right.
You know, other than that, you know, and this great
and
love.
And he's
of
observed.
His,
he's
and this
pretty.
Great,
yeah.
Yeah, and this great, you know, this great love of his life. But, you know, that's so reductive.
Incidental.
It's so reductive.
I would think it is an insult.
It's so
Let
reductive.
Me just say too, for a movie to be about over 80 years of a man's life, I'm sure when people die, when I die, and when I've seen family members die, the things that touch us most aren't the really deep, you know, they aren't the really deep thoughts. They're the simple kind of pleasures in life that we look back on. That's why you always hear people say, man, things were so simple back then, and we can't reminisce over that. You know, that's what we cherish.
It's almost the inanities of life. You know, the real, you know, the stuff that to an outsider who never knew the person, and you try to explain to them, and they're like, "That's the thing, you know. It, you know, that's the thing you remember, or that's the thing, you know." And it, if you, you know, it's one of those deals that, yeah, it is those little things. And Benjamin Button, and so by Benjamin Button zeroing in on that aspect of human nature and human life,
right,
behavior, I think that's what I think audiences will connect. I'm not good at predicting, you know, success. I'm really not, at least on these types of films. But when I did see it, audiences really did connect. There is a humor in the film. There is a romanticism in the film. And just the scope of the film, it does take a little bit to get going. It's not until the film hits World War II that everything really starts to click and rolling on, you know, start, you know, going on all cylinders. And from that point on, which is like over 2 hours, the
mm-hmm.
film doesn't let up. And there are so many sequences that are just, you know, breathtaking in what
mm-hmm.
they're conveying. I'll just say once again, and it's not a plot point at all, but there's a sequence that I'll just call the 60s, if you will. It's the 60s, and it's Benjamin Button in a happy time in his life. And David Fincher, you know, we're speaking of music, he has this score, but he also has perfectly selected period music. It's set in New Orleans,
right,
and other stuff, but he's not picking the obvious quote-unquote hits
mm-hmm.
to cue you in at the time. But in the 60s, he picks a song that you could say is sort of obvious, but it isn't. And when that song comes on and the scene goes to that scene just goes off into the stratosphere. That sequence goes off into
wow.
the stratosphere.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And that's when I really knew that I was with this film, that I had really gotten on the train with this film. And that sequence just, it brought a tear to my eye, but not of sadness, but of real joy.
Yeah.
It's just a terrific film. And in the Fincher canon, you know, I don't, you know, we can, that can be another discussion. Is it better than Zodiac? Is it better than Fight Club? That's a whole different discussion. What I will say that is interesting to note, that this is, in an odd way, the the total antithesis to Fight Club. I think you could say that Fincher has matured to such a degree as a person, as a filmmaker, that he still is bemused by life, but where Fight Club was a man in his late 20s, early 30s type of movie that was kind of blustery and, you know, pumped up, you know, now that Fincher's in his mid-40s, I think he's starting to reach that point where he's a little reflective and he's a little more bemused by life, and I think this is the film of it, of that, reflects that.
Yeah. Well, when it opens Christmas Day and we're all able to see it, we'll have you back on so we can reflect on it together.
Yeah.
But speaking of music, we're going to close out the show tonight with a piece of music from Alexander Splatt's new score for Benjamin Button, which is currently available. It is gorgeous. Go out and get it. It's 2 discs. It's a great package, too. Just very attractive. But we'll give you a taste of it when we let you go now.
Right.
Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, Jerry.
Talk to you later, guys.
All right.
We'll see everyone Sunday night for our special show dedicated to the film The Spirit. We'll see you then. Bye-bye, guys.